Chapter 14. On Monday morning, James drove Anne back to London and changed into the most debonair of his suits. Anne had to return to work, despite James's suggestion that she should accompany him to Ascot. She felt the others would not approve of her presence, and would suspect that James had confided in her. Although James had not told her the details of the Monte Carlo exercise, Anne knew every step of the planned proceedings at Ascot, and she could tell that James was nervous. Still, she would be seeing him that night and would know the worst by then. James looked lost. Anne was only thankful that Stephen, Robin and Jean-Pierre held the baton most of the time in this relay team, but the idea that was taking shape in her mind just might surprise them all. Stephen rose early and admired his grey hair in the mirror. The result had been expensively achieved the previous day in the hairdressing salon of Debenhams. He dressed carefully, putting on his one respectable grey suit and blue checked tie. These were brought out for all special occasions, ranging from a talk to students at Sussex University to a dinner with the American ambassador. No one had told him the colours clashed and the suit sagged unfashionably at the elbow and knees because by Stephen's standards it was elegance itself. He travelled from Oxford to Ascot by train, while Jean-Pierre came from London by car. They met up with James at the Belvedere Arms at 11 a.m., almost a mile from the course. Stephen immediately telephoned Robin to confirm that all three of them had arrived, and asked for the telegram to be read over to him. "That's perfect, Robin. Now travel to Heathrow and send it at exactly 1 p.m. Good luck, Stephen. Grind the bastard into the dust." Stephen returned to the others and confirmed that Robin had the London end under control. "Off you go, James, and let us know the minute Harvey arrives." James downed a bottle of Carlsberg and departed. The problem was that he kept bumping into friends, and he could hardly explain why he was prevented from joining them. Harvey arrived at the members' car park just after midday, his white Rolls-Royce shining like a Purcell advertisement. The car was being stared at by all the racegoers with an English disdain which Harvey mistook for admiration. He led his party to the private box. His newly tailored suit had taxed the ingenuity of Bernard Wetherill to the utmost. A red carnation in his buttonhole and a hat to cover his bald head left him nearly unrecognizable, and James might have missed him had it not been for the white Rolls-Royce. James followed the little group at a careful distance until he saw Harvey enter a door marked "Mr. Harvey Metcalf and Guests." "He's in his private box," said James. "Where are you?" asked Jean-Pierre. "Directly below him on the ground level by a coarse bookmaker called Sam O'Flaherty."
"No need to be rude about the Irish, James," said Jean-Pierre. "We'll be with you in a few minutes."
James stared up at the vast white stand, which accommodated 10,000 spectators in comfort and gave an excellent view of the racecourse. He was finding it hard to concentrate on the job in hand, as once again he had to avoid relations and friends. First was the Earl of Halifax, and then that frightful girl he had so unwisely agreed to take to Queen Charlotte's ball last spring. What was the creature's name? Ah, yes, the Honourable Selina Wallop. How appropriate. She was wearing a miniskirt that was a good 4 years out of fashion, and a hat which looked as if it could never come into fashion. James jammed his trilby over his ears, looked the other way, and passed the time by chatting to Sam O'Flaherty about the 320, the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth stakes. O'Flaherty quoted the latest odds on the favourite at the top of his voice. "Rosalie at 6-4, owned by that American Harvey Metcalf, and ridden by Pat Edry." Edry was on the way to becoming the youngest ever champion jockey, and Harvey always backed winners. Stephen and Jean-Pierre joined James at the side of Sam O'Flaherty's bag. His tic-tac man was standing on an upturned orange box beside him and swinging his arms like a semaphore sailor aboard a sinking ship. "What's your fancy, gentlemen?" Sam asked the three of them. James ignored Stephen's slight frown of disapproval. £5 each way on Rosalie," he said, and handed over a crisp £10 note, receiving in return a little green card with the series number and Sam O'Flaherty stamped right across the middle.
"I must presume, James, this is an integral part of your as-yet-undisclosed plan," said Jean-Pierre. "What I should like to know is if it works. How much do we stand to make?"
£9.10 after tax if Rosalie wins," chipped in Sam O'Flaherty, his stub cigar bobbing up and down in his mouth as he spoke. "Hardly a great contribution toward $1 million, James. Well, we're off to the members' enclosure. Let us know the moment Harvey leaves his box.
My guess is that around 1:45 you'll come and look at the runners and riders for the 2 o'clock, so that gives us a clear hour. The waiter opened another bottle of Krug 1964 and began pouring it for Harvey's guests. Three bankers, two economists, a couple of shipowners, and a distinguished city journalist. Preferring his guests to be famous and influential, Harvey invited people who would find it almost impossible to refuse because of the business he might put their way. He was delighted with the company he had assembled for his big day. Senior among them was Sir Howard Dodd, the aging chairman of the merchant bank that bore his name, but which actually referred to his great-grandfather. Sir Howard was 6 feet 2 inches, as straight as a ramrod, and looked more like a grenadier guard than a respectable banker. The only thing he had in common with Harvey was the hair, or lack of hair, on his balding head. His young assistant, Jamie Clark, accompanied him. Just over 30 and extremely bright, he was there to be sure his chairman did not commit the bank to anything he might later regret. Although he had a sneaking admiration for Harvey, Clark did not think him the sort of customer the bank should do business with. Nevertheless, he was far from averse to a day at the races. The two economists, Mr. Colin Empson and Dr. Michael Hogan from the Hudson Institute, were there to brief Harvey on the parlous state of the British economy. They could not have been more different. Empson was a totally self-made man who had left school at 15 and educated himself. Using his social contacts, he had built up a company specializing in taxation, which had been remarkably successful thanks to the British government's habit of putting through a new finance act every few weeks. Empson was 6 feet tall, solid and genial, game to help the party along whether Harvey lost or won. Hogan, in contrast, had been to all the right places, Winchester, Trinity College, Oxford, and the Wharton Business School in Pennsylvania. A spell with McKinsey, the management consultants, in London, had made him one of the best-informed economists in Europe. Those who observed his slim, sinewy body would not have been surprised to learn that he had been an international squash player. Dark-haired, with brown eyes that rarely left Harvey, he found it hard not to show his contempt. This was his 5th invitation to Ascot. Harvey, it seemed, was never going to take no for an answer. The Koundas brothers, second-generation Greeks, who loved racing almost as much as ships, could hardly be told apart, with their black hair, swarthy skins, and heavy, dark eyebrows. It was difficult to guess how old they were, and nobody knew how much they were worth. They probably did not know themselves. Harvey's final guest, Nick Lloyd of the News of the World, had come along to pick up any dirt he could about his host. He had come near to exposing Metcalfe in the mid-60s, but another scandal had kept less juicy stories off the front page for several weeks, and by then Harvey had escaped. Lloyd, hunched over the inevitable triple gin with a faint suggestion of tonic, watched the motley bunch with interest. "Telegram for you, sir." Harvey ripped it open. He was never neat about anything. "It's from my daughter, Rosalie. It's cute of her to remember, but damn it all, I named the horse after her. Come on, everybody, let's eat." They all took their seats for lunch. Cold vichyssoise, pheasant, and strawberries. Harvey was even more loquacious than usual, but his guests took no notice, aware he was nervous before the race, and knowing that he would rather be a winner of this trophy than any he could be offered in America. Harvey himself could never understand why he felt that way. Perhaps it was the special atmosphere of Ascot which appealed to him so strongly, the combination of lush green grass and gracious surroundings, of elegant crowds and an efficiency of organization which made Ascot the envy of the racing world.
"You must have a better chance this year than ever before, Harvey," said the senior banker. "Well, you know, Sir Howard, Lester Piggott is riding the Duke of Devonshire's horse, Crown Princess, and the Queen's horse, Highclere, is the joint favourite, so I can't afford to overestimate my chances. When you've been third twice before, and then favourite and not placed, you begin to wonder if one of your horses is going to make it. Another telegram, sir." Once again Harvey's fat little finger ripped it open. "All best wishes and good luck for the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes. It's from the staff of your bank, Sir Howard. Jolly good show." Harvey's Polish-American accent made the English expression sound slightly ridiculous. "More champagne, everybody." Another telegram arrived.
"At this rate, Harvey, you'll need a special room at the post office."
There was laughter all around at Sir Howard's feeble joke.
Once again, Harvey read it out loud.
Regret unable to join you, Ascot. Heading soonest California. Grateful lookout for old friend Professor Rodney Porter, Oxford Nobel Prize winner. Don't let English bookies stitch you up. Wiley B. Heathrow Airport.
It's from Wiley Barker.
He's the guy who did stitch me up in Monte Carlo. He saved my life. He took out a gallstone the size of that bread roll you're eating, Dr. Hogan. Now how the hell am I supposed to find this Professor Porter?
Harvey turned to the head waiter.
Find my chauffeur. A few seconds later, the smartly clad Guy Salmon flunky appeared. There's a Professor Rodney Porter of Oxford here today. Go find him.
What does he look like, sir?
How the hell do I know? Said Harvey. Like a professor.
The chauffeur regretfully abandoned his plans for an afternoon at the railings and departed, leaving Harvey and his guests to enjoy the strawberries, the champagne, and the string of telegrams that were still arriving.
You know if you win, the cap will be presented by the Queen, said Nick Lloyd.
You bet. It'll be the crowning moment of my life to win the King George and Elizabeth stakes and meet Her Majesty the Queen. If Rosalie wins, I'll suggest my daughter marries Prince Charles. They're about the same age.
I don't think even you will be able to fix that, Harvey.
What'll you do with the odd £81,000 prize money, Mr. Metcalf? Asked Jamie Clark.
Give it to some charity, said Harvey, pleased with the impression the remark made on his guests.
Very generous, Harvey. Typical of your reputation. Nick Lloyd gave Michael Hogan a knowing look. Even if the others didn't, they both knew what was typical of his reputation. The chauffeur returned to report that there was no trace of a solitary professor anywhere in the champagne bar, balcony luncheon room, or the paddock buffet, and that he'd been unable to gain access to the members' enclosure.
Naturally not, said Harvey rather pompously. I shall have to find him myself. Drink up and enjoy yourselves.
Harvey rose and walked to the door with the chauffeur. Once he was out of earshot of his guests, he said,
Get your ass out of here, and don't give me any crap about not being able to find him, or you can find something for yourself, another job.
The chauffeur bolted. Harvey turned to his guests and smiled.
I'm going to look at the runners and riders for the 2 o'clock.
He's leaving the box now, said James.
What's that you're saying? Asked an authoritative voice he recognized. Talking to yourself, James?
James stared at the noble Lord Somerset, 6 feet 1 inch and still able to stand his full height, an MC and a DSO in the First World War. He still exuded enthusiastic energy, although the lines on his face suggested that he had passed the age at which the Maker had fulfilled his contract.
Oh, hell, no, sir, I was just, coughing. What do you fancy in the King George the Sixth and Queen Elizabeth stakes? Asked the peer of the realm.
Well, I have put £5 each way on Rosalie, sir.
He seems to have cut himself off, said Stephen.
Well, buzz him again, said Jean-Pierre.
What's that noise, James? Have you taken to a hearing aid or something?
No, sir, it's a transistor radio.
Those things ought to be banned. Bloody invasion of privacy.
Absolutely right, sir.
What's he playing at, Stephen?
I don't know. I think something must have happened. Oh, my God, it's Harvey, heading straight for us. You go into the members' enclosure, Stephen, and I'll follow you. Take a deep breath and relax. He hasn't seen us.
Harvey marched up to the official blocking the entrance to the members' enclosure.
I'm Harvey Metcalf, the owner of Rosalie, and this is my badge.
The official let Harvey through. 30 years ago, he thought, they would not have let him into the members' enclosure if he'd owned every horse in the race. Then, racing at Ascot was only held on 4 days a year. Jolly social occasions. Now it was 24 days a year and big business. Times had changed. Jean-Pierre followed closely, showing his pass without speaking to the official. A photographer broke away from stalking the outrageous hats for which Ascot has such a reputation and took a picture of Harvey just in case Rosalie won the King George the Sixth stakes. As soon as his bulb flashed, he rushed over to the other entrance, where Linda Lovelace, the star of Deep Throat, the film running to packed houses in New York but banned in England, was trying to enter the members' enclosure. In spite of being introduced to a well-known London banker, Richard Spiro, just as he was entering the enclosure, she was not succeeding. She was wearing a top hat and morning suit, with nothing under the top coat, and no one was going to bother with Harvey while she was around. when Miss Lovelace was quite certain that every photographer had taken a picture of her attempting to enter the enclosure, she left, swearing at the top of her voice, her publicity stunt completed. Harvey returned to studying the horses as Stephen moved up to within a few feet of him.
"Here we go again," said Jean-Pierre in French, and went smartly over to Stephen and, standing directly between the two of them, shook Stephen's hand warmly, declaring in a voice that was intended to carry, "How are you, Professor Potter? I didn't know you were interested in racing."
"I'm not, really. But I was on my way back from a seminar in London and thought it a good opportunity to see how..."
"Professor Potter!" cried Harvey. "I'm honored to make your acquaintance, sir. My name is Harvey Metcalf, from Boston, Massachusetts. My good friend Dr. Wiley Barker, who saved my life, told me you'd be here today on your own, and I'm going to make sure you have a wonderful afternoon."
Jean-Pierre slipped away unnoticed. He could not believe how easy it had been. The telegram had worked like a charm. "Her Majesty the Queen, His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh, Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother, and Her Royal Highness the Princess Anne are now entering the royal box." The massed bands of the Brigade of Guards struck up the national anthem, "God Save the Queen." The crowd of 25,000 rose and sang loyally out of tune.
"We should have someone like that in America," said Harvey to Stephen, "to take the place of Richard Nixon. We wouldn't have any Watergate problems then."
Stephen thought his fellow American was being just a little unfair. Richard Nixon was almost a saint, by Harvey Metcalf's standards.
"Come and join me in my box, Professor, and meet my other guests. The damned box costs me £750. We may as well fill it. Have you had some lunch?"
"Yes, I've had an excellent lunch. Thank you,"
Stephen lied. Something else Harvey had taught him. He had stood by the members' enclosure for an hour, nervous and pensive, unable even to manage a sandwich, and now he was starving.
"Well, come and enjoy the champagne," roared Harvey.
"On an empty stomach," thought Stephen.
"Thank you, Mr. Metcalf. I am a little lost. This is my first Royal Ascot."
"This isn't Royal Ascot, Professor. It's the last day of Ascot Week. But the royal family always comes to see the King George and Elizabeth stakes, so everybody dresses up."
"I see," said Stephen timidly, pleased with his deliberate error.
Harvey collared his find and took him back to the box.
"Everybody, I want you to meet my distinguished friend, Rodney Porter. He's a Nobel Prize winner, you know. By the way, what's your subject, Rod?"
"Biochemistry."
Stephen was getting the measure of Harvey. As long as he played it straight, the bankers and shippers and even the journalists would never doubt that he was the cleverest thing since Einstein. He relaxed a little and even found time to fill himself with smoked salmon sandwiches when the others were not looking. Lester Piggott won the 2 o'clock on Olympic Casino and the 2:30 on Rusalka, achieving his 3,000th win. Harvey was getting steadily more nervous. He talked incessantly without making much sense. He had sat through the 2:30 without showing any interest in the result, and consumed more and more champagne. At 2:50, he called for them all to join him in the members' enclosure to look at his famous filly. Stephen, like the others, trailed behind him in a little pseudo-royal entourage. Jean-Pierre and James watched the procession from a distance.
"He's too deep in to climb out now," said Jean-Pierre.
"He looks relaxed enough to me," replied James. "Let's make ourselves scarce. We can only get under his feet."
They headed into the champagne bar, which was filled with red-faced men who looked as if they spent more time drinking than they did watching the racing.
"Isn't she beautiful, Professor? Almost as beautiful as my daughter. If she doesn't win today, I don't think I'm ever going to make it."
Harvey left his little clique to have a word with the jockey, Pat Edry, to wish him luck. Peter Wallen, the trainer, was giving final instructions before the jockey mounted and left the enclosure. The 10 horses were then paraded in front of the stand before the race, a custom only carried out at Ascot for the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth stakes. The gold, purple and scarlet colours of Her Majesty the Queen's horse, Highclere, led the procession, followed by Crown Princess, who was giving Lester Piggott a little trouble. Directly behind her came Rosalie, looking very relaxed, fresh and ready to go. Boy and Dankero trotted behind Rosalie, with the outsiders, Mesopotamia, Ropey and Minnow, bringing up the rear. The crowd rose to cheer the horses, and Harvey beamed with pride.
as if he owned every horse in the race. "And I have with me today the distinguished American owner, Harvey Metcalf," said Julian Wilson into the BBC TV outside broadcast camera. "I'm going to ask him if he'd be kind enough to give me his views on the King George the Sixth and Queen Elizabeth Stakes, for which he has the joint favourite, Rosalie. Welcome to England, Mr. Metcalf. How do you feel about the big race?"
"It's a thrill to be here, just to participate in the race once again. Rosalie's got a great chance. Still, it's not winning that matters. It's taking part."
Stephen flinched. Baron de Coubertin, who had first made that remark when opening the 1896 Olympics, must have turned in his grave.
"The latest betting shows Rosalie to be the joint favourite with Her Majesty the Queen's horse, Highclere. How do you feel about that?"
"I'm just as worried about the Duke of Devonshire's Crown Princess. Leicester Piggott is always hard to beat on a great occasion. He won the first two races, and he'll be all set for this one. Crown Princess is a fine little filly."
"Is a mile and a half a good distance for Rosalie?"
"Results this season show it's definitely her best distance. What will you do with the £81,240 prize money? The money is not important. It hasn't even entered my mind."
It had certainly entered Stephen's mind. "Thank you, Mr. Metcalf, and the best of luck. And now over for the latest news of the betting." Harvey moved back to his group of admirers and suggested that they return to watch the race from the balcony just outside his box. Stephen was fascinated to observe Harvey at such close quarters. He had become nervous, and even more mendacious than usual under pressure, not at all the icy, cool operator they had all feared him to be. This man was human, susceptible, and could be beaten. They all leaned over the rails watching the horses being put into the stalls. Crown Princess was still giving a little trouble while all the others waited. The tension was becoming unbearable.
"They're off," boomed the loudspeaker.
As 25,000 people raised glasses to their eyes, Harvey said,
"She's got a good start. She's well placed,"
continuing to give everybody a running commentary until the last mile, when he became silent. The others also waited in silence, intent on the loudspeaker.
"They're into the straight mile. Minnow leads the field around the bend, with Boy and Dankaro looking relaxed just tucked in behind him, followed by Crown Princess, Rosalie and Highclere. As they approach the 6-furlong marker, Rosalie and Crown Princess come up on the stand side with Highclere making a bid. 5 furlongs to go. Minnow still sets the pace, but is beginning to tire as Crown Princess and Boy make up ground. 0.5 mile to go. Minnow still just ahead of Boy, who has moved up into second place, perhaps making her move too early. 3 furlongs from home. They're quickening up just a little. Minnow sets the pace on the rails. Boy and Dankaro are now about a length behind, followed by Rosalie, Leicester Piggott on Crown Princess, and the Queen's filly Highclere all making ground. Inside the 2-furlong marker, Highclere and Rosalie move up to challenge Boy. Crown Princess is right out of it now. 1 furlong to go.
The commentator's voice rose in pitch and volume.
"It's Joe Mercer riding Highclere who hits the front, just ahead of Pat Edry on Rosalie. 200 yards to go, they're neck and neck, 100 yards to go. It's anybody's race, and on the line it's a photo finish between the gold, purple and scarlet colours of Her Majesty the Queen and the black and green check colours of the American owner Harvey Metcalf. Monsieur Moussac's Dankaro was third."
Harvey stood paralysed, waiting for the result. Even Stephen felt a little sympathy for him. None of Harvey's guests dared to speak for fear they might be wrong.
"The result of the King George the Sixth and the Queen Elizabeth Stakes."
Once again the loudspeaker boomed out, and silence fell over the whole course.
"The winner is number 5, Rosalie."
The rest of the result was lost in the roar of the crowd and the bellow of triumph from Harvey. Pursued by his guests, he raced to the nearest lift, pressed a pound note into the lift girl's hand and shouted,
"Get this thing moving!"
Only half of his guests managed to jump in with him. Stephen was among them. Once they reached the ground floor, the lift gates opened and Harvey came out like a thoroughbred, past the champagne bar, through the rear of the members' enclosure, into the winner's enclosure, and flung his arms around the horse's neck, almost unseating the jockey. A few minutes later, he triumphantly led Rosalie to the little white post marked first. The crowd thronged around him, offering their congratulations. The clerk of the course, Captain Beaumont, stood by Harvey's side, briefing him on the procedure that would be followed when he was presented. Lord Abergavenny, the Queen's representative at Ascot, accompanied Her Majesty to the winner's enclosure.
"The winner of the King George VI and the Queen Elizabeth Stakes,
Mr. Harvey Metcalfe's Rosalie.
Harvey was in a dream world. Flash bulbs popped, and film cameras followed him as he walked toward the Queen. He bowed and received his trophy. The Queen, resplendent in a turquoise silk suit and matching turban that could only have been designed by Norman Hartnell, said a few words, but for the first time in his life, Harvey was speechless. Taking a pace backward, he bowed again and returned to his place accompanied by loud applause. Back in his box, the champagne flowed and everybody was Harvey's friend. Stephen realized this was not the moment to try anything clever. He must bide his time and watch his quarry's reaction to these changed circumstances. He stayed quietly in a corner, letting the excitement subside, and observed Harvey carefully. It took another race before Harvey was half back to normal, and Stephen decided the time had now come to act. He made as if to leave.
"Are you going already, Professor?"
"Yes, Mr. Metcalfe. I must return to Oxford and mark some scripts before tomorrow morning.
I always admire the work you boys put in. I hope you enjoyed yourself."
Stephen avoided Shaw's famous riposte. "I had to. There was nothing else to enjoy."
"Yes, thank you, Mr. Metcalfe. An amazing achievement. You must be a very proud man." "Well, I guess so. It's been a long time coming, but it all seems worthwhile now. Rod, it's too bad you have to leave us. Can't you stay on a little longer and join my party at Claridge's tonight?"
"I should have liked that, Mr. Metcalfe. But you must visit me at my college at Oxford and allow me to show you the university."
"That's swell. I have a couple of days after Ascot, and I've always wanted to see Oxford, but I never seem to have found the time.
It's the university garden party next Wednesday. Why don't you join me for dinner at my college on Tuesday evening, and then we can spend the following day looking at the university and go on to the garden party?"
Stephen scribbled a few directions on a card.
"Fantastic. This is turning out to be the best vacation I've ever had in Europe. How are you getting back to Oxford, Professor?"
"By train."
No, said Harvey. "My Rolls-Royce will take you. It'll be back well in time for the last race."
And before Stephen could protest, the chauffeur was called for. "Take Professor Porter back to Oxford and then return here. Have a good trip, Professor. I look forward to seeing you next Tuesday at 8 p.m.
Great meeting you."
"Thank you for a wonderful day, Mr. Metcalfe, and congratulations on your splendid victory." Seated in the back of the white Rolls-Royce on his way to Oxford, the car which Robin had boasted he and he alone would travel in, Stephen relaxed and smiled to himself. Taking a small notebook from his pocket, he made an entry. Deduct 98 pence from expenses, the price of a single second-class ticket from Ascot to Oxford.
Chapter 15.
"Bradley," said the senior tutor, "you're going a bit grey at the edges, dear boy. Is the office of junior dean proving too much for you?"
Stephen had wondered whether any of the senior common room would think the change in the colour of his hair worthy of comment. Dons are seldom surprised by anything their colleagues do. "My father went grey at an early age, senior tutor, and there seems to be no way of defying heredity."
"Ah, well, dear boy, you'll look all the more distinguished at next week's garden party."
"Oh, yes," replied Stephen, who had been thinking of nothing else. "I'd quite forgotten about that." He returned to his rooms, where the rest of the team were assembled and waiting for the next briefing.
"Wednesday is the big day of the insignia and the garden party," began Stephen without as much as a "good morning, gentlemen." His students made no protest. "Now, the one thing we've learned about our millionaire friend is that when we take him away from his own environment, he still continues to assume he knows everything. We've now shown that his bluff can be called, as long as we know what's going to happen next and he doesn't. It's only the same skill he used when promoting Prospector Oil, always keeping one step ahead of us. Now, we're going to keep two steps ahead of him by having a rehearsal today and a full dress rehearsal tomorrow."
"Time spent on reconnaissance is seldom wasted," muttered James. It was about the only sentiment he could recall from his army cadet days at Harrow.
"Haven't had to spend much time on reconnaissance for your plan, have we?"
chipped in Jean-Pierre. Stephen ignored the interruptions. "Now, the whole process, on the day,
will take about 7 hours for me and 4 hours for you, which includes the time required for makeup. We'll need an extra session on that from James the day before. How often will you need my two sons? Asked Robin. Only once. On the Wednesday. Too many runs at it will make them look stiff and awkward. When do you imagine Harvey will want to return to London? Inquired Jean-Pierre. I rang Guy Salmon to check their timetable, and they've been instructed to have him back at Claridge's by 7 p.m., so I've assumed we have only until 5:30. Clever, said Robin. It's awful, said Stephen. I even think like the man now. Right, let's go over the whole plan once again. We'll take it from the red dossier, halfway down page 16. When I leave All Souls. On Sunday and Monday, they carried out full rehearsals. By the Tuesday, they knew every route Harvey could take, and where he would be at any given moment of the day from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Stephen hoped he had covered every eventuality. He had little choice. They were only going to be allowed one crack at this one. Any mistakes like Monte Carlo, and there would be no second chance. The dress rehearsal went to a second. I haven't worn clothes like this since I was 6 years old and attending a fancy dress party, said Jean-Pierre. We're going to be anything but inconspicuous. There'll be red and blue and black all around you on the day, said Stephen. It's like a circus for peacocks. No one will give us a second look, not even you, Jean-Pierre. They were all nervous again, waiting for the curtain to go up. Stephen was glad they were on edge. He had no doubt that the moment they relaxed with Harvey Metcalf, they would be found out. The team spent a quiet weekend. Stephen watched the College Dramatic Society's annual effort in Magdalen Gardens. Robin took his wife to Glyndebourne and was uncommonly attentive. Jean-Pierre read Goodbye Picasso by David Douglas Duncan. And James took Anne to Tathwell Hall in Lincolnshire to meet his father, the 5th Earl. Even Anne was nervous that weekend. Harry, Dr. Bradley, I have an American guest dining with me in my rooms tonight. His name is Harvey Metcalf. When he arrives, will you see he is brought over to my rooms, please? Certainly, sir. And one small thing. He seems to have mistaken me for Professor Porter of Trinity College. Don't correct the mistake, will you? Just humor him. Certainly, sir. Harry retreated into the porter's lodge, shaking his head sadly. Of course, all academics went dotty in the end, but Dr. Bradley had been afflicted at an unusually tender age. Harvey arrived at 8. He was always on time in England. The head porter guided him through the cloisters and up the old stone staircase to Stephen's rooms. "Mr. Metcalf, sir. How are you, Professor?" "I'm well, Mr. Metcalf. Good of you to be so punctual. Punctuality is the politeness of princes. I think you'll find it is the politeness of kings, and in this particular instance, of Louis XVIII. For a moment, Stephen forgot that Harvey wasn't a pupil. "I'm sure you're right, Professor." Stephen mixed him a large whiskey. His guest's eyes took in the room and settled on the desk. "Gee, what a wonderful set of photographs. You with the late President Kennedy, another with the Queen and even the Pope." That touch was due to Jean-Pierre, who had put Stephen in contact with a photographer who had been in jail with his artist friend David Stein. Stephen was already looking forward to burning the photographs and pretending they had never existed. "Let me give you another to add to your collection." Harvey pulled out of his inside coat pocket a large photograph of himself receiving the trophy for the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes from the Queen. "I'll sign it for you if you like." Without waiting for a reply, he scribbled an exuberant signature diagonally across the Queen. "Thank you," said Stephen. "I can assure you I will treasure it with the same affection as I do my other photographs. I certainly appreciate your sparing the time to visit me here, Mr. Metcalf. It's an honor for me to come to Oxford, and this is such a lovely old college." Stephen really believed he meant it, and he suppressed the inclination to tell Harvey the story of the late Lord Nuffield's dinner at Magdalen. For all Nuffield's munificence to the university, the two were never on entirely easy terms. When a manservant assisted the guest's departure after a college feast, Nuffield took the proffered hat ungraciously. "Is this mine?" he said disdainfully. "I wouldn't know, my lord," was the rejoinder, "but it's the one you came with."
Harvey was gazing a little blankly at the books on Stephen's shelves. The disparity between their subject matter, pure mathematics, and the putative Professor Porter's discipline, biochemistry, happily failed to arrest him.
"Do brief me on tomorrow."
"Surely," said Stephen. Why not? He had briefed everyone else. "Let me first call for dinner, and I'll go through what I've planned for you and see if it meets with your approval. I'm game for anything. I feel 10 years younger since this trip to Europe. It must have been the operation. And I'm thrilled about being here at Oxford University." Stephen wondered if he really could stand 7 hours of Harvey Metcalf, but for another $250,000 and his reputation with the rest of the team. The college servants brought in shrimp cocktail.
"My favourite," said Harvey. "How did you know?"
Stephen would have liked to say, "There's very little I don't know about you," but he satisfied himself with a fortunate guess. "Now, if we meet up at 10 tomorrow morning, we can take part in what is thought to be the most interesting day in the university calendar. It's called Insignia."
"What's that?"
"Well, once a year at the end of Trinity term, which is the equivalent of the summer term in an American university, we celebrate the ending of the university year. There are several ceremonies, followed by a magnificent garden party, which will be attended by the Chancellor and Vice-Chancellor of the university. The Chancellor is the former British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, and the Vice-Chancellor is Mr. Habakkuk. I'm hoping it will be possible for you to meet them both, and we should manage to cover everything in time for you to be back in London by 7 p.m.
"How did you know I had to be back by 7?
"You warned me at Ascot." Stephen could lie very quickly now. He was afraid that if they did not get their million soon, he would end up a hardened criminal. Harvey enjoyed his meal, which Stephen had planned almost too cleverly, each course featuring one of Harvey's favourite dishes. After Harvey had drunk a good deal of after-dinner brandy, price £7.25 per bottle, thought Stephen, they strolled through the quiet Magdalen cloisters past the song school. The sound of the choristers rehearsing a Gabrielli Mass hung gently in the air.
"Gee, I'm surprised you allow record players on that loud," said Harvey.
Stephen escorted his guest to the Randolph Hotel, pointing out the Iron Cross set in Broad Street outside Balliol College, said to mark the spot on which Archbishop Cranmer was burned at the stake for heresy in 1556. Harvey forbore to say that he had never even heard of the reverend gentleman. Stephen and Harvey parted on the steps of the Randolph.
"See you in the morning, Professor. Thanks for a great evening."
"My pleasure. I'll pick you up at 10 a.m. Sleep well. You have a full day ahead of you tomorrow." Stephen returned to Magdalen and immediately called Robin. "All's well, but I nearly went too far. The meal was altogether too carefully chosen. I even had his favourite brandy. Still, it'll keep me on my toes tomorrow. We must remember to avoid overkill. See you then, Robin." Stephen reported the same message to Jean-Pierre and James before falling gratefully into bed. The same time tomorrow he would be a wiser man, but would he be a richer one?
Chapter 16. At 5 a.m. the sun rose over the Cherwell, and those few Oxonians who were about that early would have been left in no doubt as to why the connoisseurs consider Magdalen to be the most beautiful college at either Oxford or Cambridge. Nestling on the banks of the river, its perpendicular architecture is easy on the eye. King Edward VII, Prince Henry, Cardinal Wolsey, Edward Gibbon, and Oscar Wilde had all passed through its portals, but the only thing that was passing through Stephen's mind as he lay awake that morning was the education of Harvey Metcalf. He could hear his own heartbeat, and for the first time he knew what Robin and Jean-Pierre had been through. It seemed a lifetime since their first meeting only 3 months before. He smiled to himself at the thought of how close they had all become in their common aim of defeating Harvey Metcalf. Although Stephen, like James, was beginning to have a sneaking admiration for the man, he was now even more convinced that Metcalf could be outmaneuvered when he was not on home ground. For over 2 hours, Stephen lay motionless in bed, deep in thought, going over his plan again and again. When the sun had climbed over the tallest tree, he rose, showered, shaved, and dressed slowly and deliberately, his mind still on the day ahead. He made his face up carefully to age himself by 15 years. It took him a considerable time, and he wondered whether women had to struggle as long in front of the mirror to achieve the opposite effect. He donned his gown, a magnificent scarlet, proclaiming him a Doctor of Philosophy of the University of Oxford. It amused him that Oxford had to be different. Every other university abbreviated this universal award for research work to PhD. In Oxford, it was D.Phil. He studied himself in the mirror. If that doesn't impress Harvey Metcalf, nothing ever will. And what's more, he had the right to wear it. He sat down to study his red dossier for the last time. He had read the closely typewritten pages so often that he practically knew them by heart. He avoided breakfast. Looking nearly 50, he would undoubtedly have caused a stir among his colleagues, though probably the older dons would have failed to observe anything unusual in his appearance. Stephen headed out of the college into the High, unnoticed among the thousand or so other graduates, all dressed like 14th-century archbishops. Anonymity on that particular day was going to be easy. That, and the fact that Harvey would be bemused by the strange traditions of the ancient university, were the two reasons why Stephen had chosen Encinia for his day of battle. He arrived at the Randolph at 9:55 a.m., and informed one of the younger bellboys that his name was Professor Porter, and that he had come to pick up Mr. Metcalf. Stephen took a seat in the lounge. The young man scurried away and returned moments later with Harvey. "Mr. Metcalf, Professor Porter." "Thank you," said Stephen. He made a mental note to return and tip the bellboy. That touch had been useful, even if it was only part of his job.
"Good morning, Professor," said Harvey, taking a seat. "So tell me, what have I let myself in for?"
"Well," said Stephen, "Encinia begins officially when all the notables of the university take a breakfast of champagne, strawberries, and cream at Jesus College, which is known as Lord Nathaniel Crewe's benefaction.
Who's this Lord Crewe guy? Will he be at the breakfast?"
"Only in spirit. The great man died some 300 years ago. Lord Nathaniel Crewe was a doctor of the university and the Bishop of Durham, and he left £200 a year to the university as a benefaction to provide the breakfast and an oration, which we shall hear later. Of course, the money he willed no longer covers expenses nowadays, with rising prices and inflation, so the university has to dip into its own pocket to continue the tradition. When breakfast is over, there is a procession and parade to the Sheldonian Theatre.
What happens then?
The parade is followed by the most exciting event of the day, the presentation of the honorands for degrees."
"The what?" said Harvey.
"The honorands," said Stephen. "They are the distinguished men and women who have been chosen by the senior members of the university to be awarded Oxford honorary degrees." Stephen looked at his watch. "In fact, we must leave now to be sure of having a good position on the route from which to watch the procession." Stephen rose and guided his guest out of the Randolph Hotel. They strolled down the Broad and found an excellent spot just in front of the Sheldonian Theatre, where the police cleared a little space for Stephen because of his scarlet gown. A few minutes later, the procession wound into sight around the corner from the Turl. The police held up all the traffic and kept the public on the pavement.
"Who are the guys in front carrying those clubs?"
inquired Harvey. "They are the University Marshal and the Beadles. They are carrying maces to safeguard the Chancellor's procession."
"Jesus, of course it's safe. This isn't Central Park, New York."
"I agree," said Stephen, "but it hasn't always been so over the past 300 years, and tradition dies hard in England.
And who's that behind the Beadle fellows?"
"The one wearing the black gown with gold trimmings is the Chancellor of the University, accompanied by his page. The Chancellor is the Right Honourable Harold Macmillan, who was Prime Minister of Great Britain in the late 50s and early 60s.
"Oh yes, I remember the guy. Tried to get the British into Europe, but de Gaulle wouldn't have it."
"Well, I suppose that's one way of remembering him. Now, he's followed by the Vice-Chancellor, Mr. Habakkuk, who is also the principal of Jesus College."
"You're losing me, Professor."
"Well, the Chancellor is always a distinguished Englishman who was educated at Oxford, but the Vice-Chancellor is a leading member of the university itself and is usually chosen from the heads of one of the colleges."
"Got it, I think."
"Now, after him, we have the university registrar, Mr. Caston, who is a fellow of Merton College. He is the senior administrator of the university, or you might look on him as the university's top civil servant. He's directly responsible to the vice-chancellor and hebdomadal council, who are the sort of cabinet for the university.
Behind them we have the senior proctor, Mr. Campbell of Worcester College, and the junior proctor, the Reverend Dr. Bennett of New College.
What's a proctor?
For over 700 years, the proctors have been responsible for decency and discipline in the university.
What? Those two old men take care of 9,000 rowdy youths?
Well, they are helped by the bulldogs, said Stephen.
Ah, that's better, I suppose. A couple of bites from an old English bulldog would keep anyone in order.
No, no, protested Stephen, trying desperately not to laugh. The name bulldog is given to the men who help the proctors keep order. Now, finally, in the procession you can observe that tiny crocodile of color. It consists of heads of colleges who are doctors of the university, doctors of the university who are not heads of colleges, and the heads of colleges who are not doctors of the university, in that order.
Listen, Rod, all doctors mean to me is pain and money.
They are not that sort of doctor, replied Stephen.
Forget it. I love everything, but don't expect me to understand what it's all about.
Stephen watched Harvey's face carefully. He was drinking the scene in and had already become quieter. The long line will now proceed into the Sheldonian Theatre, and all the people in the procession will take their places in the hemicycle.
Excuse me, sir, what type of cycle is that?
The hemicycle is a round bank of seats inside the theatre, distinguished only by being the most uncomfortable in Europe. But don't you worry. Thanks to your well-known interest in education at Harvard, I've managed to arrange special seats for us, and there will just be time for us to secure them ahead of the procession.
Well, lead the way, Rod. Do they really know what goes on at Harvard here?
Why, yes, Mr. Metcalf. You have a reputation in university circles as a generous man, interested in financing the pursuit of academic excellence.
Well, what do you know?
Very little, thought Stephen. He guided Harvey to his reserved seat in the balcony, not wanting his guest to be able to see the individual men and women too clearly. The truth of the matter was that the senior members of the university and their hemicycle were so covered from head to toe in gowns and caps and bow ties and bands that even their mothers would not have recognized them. The organist played his final chord, and the guests settled.
The organist, said Stephen, is from my own college. He is the chorigus, the leader of the chorus, and deputy professor of music.
Harvey could not take his eyes off the hemicycle and the scarlet-clad figures. He had never seen a sight like it in his life. The music stopped, and the Chancellor rose to address the assembled company in vernacular Latin.
Causa huius, convocationes est ut.
What the hell's he saying?
He's telling us why we're here, explained Stephen. I'll try and guide you through it.
Ite bidellae,
declared the Chancellor, and the great doors opened for the beadles to go and fetch the honorans from the divinity school. There was a hush as they were led in by the public orator, Mr. J. G. Griffith, who presented them one by one to the Chancellor, enshrining the careers and achievements of each in polished and witty Latin prose. Stephen's translation, however, followed a rather more liberal line, and was embellished with suggestions that their doctorates were as much the result of financial generosity as of academic prowess.
That's Lord Amory. They're praising him for all the work he has done in the field of education. How much did he give?
Well, he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. And there's Lord Hailsham. He has held 8 cabinet positions, including Secretary of State for Education and, finally, Lord Chancellor. Both he and Lord Amory are receiving the degree of Doctor of Civil Law. Harvey recognized Dame Flora Robson, the actress, who was being honored for a distinguished lifetime in the theatre. Stephen explained that she was receiving the degree of Doctor of Letters, as was the Poet Laureate, Sir John Betjeman. Each was presented with his scroll by the Chancellor, shaken by the hand and then shown to a seat in the front row of the hemicycle. The final honorand was Sir George Porter, Director of the Royal Institution and Nobel Laureate. He received his honorary degree of Doctor of Science.
My namesake, but no relation. Oh, well, nearly through, said Stephen.
Just a little prose from John Wayne, the professor of poetry, about the benefactors of the university. Mr. Wayne delivered the Cruian oration, which took him some 12 minutes, and Stephen was grateful for something so lively in a language they could both understand. He was only vaguely aware of the recitations of undergraduate prize winners which concluded the proceedings.
The Chancellor of the University rose and led the procession out of the hall.
"Where are they all off to now?"
asked Harvey. "They are going to have lunch at All Souls, where they will be joined by other distinguished guests."
"God, what I would give to be able to attend that."
"I have arranged it," replied Stephen. Harvey was quite overwhelmed.
"How did you fix that, Professor?"
"The registrar was most impressed by the interest you have shown in Harvard, and I think they hope you might find it possible to assist Oxford in some small way, especially after your wonderful win at Ascot."
"What a great idea. Why didn't I think of that?"
Stephen tried to show little interest, hoping that by the end of the day he would have thought of that. He had learned his lesson on overkill. The truth was that the registrar had never heard of Harvey Metcalf, but because it was Stephen's last term at Oxford, he had been put on the list of invitations by a friend who was a fellow of All Souls. They walked over to All Souls, just across the road from the Sheldonian Theatre. Stephen attempted, without much success, to explain the nature of All Souls to Harvey. Indeed, many Oxonians themselves find the college something of an enigma.
"Its corporate name," Stephen began, "is the College of All Souls of the Faithful Departed of Oxford, and it resonantly commemorates the victors of Agincourt. It was intended that masses should forever be said there for the repose of their souls. Its modern role is unique in academic life. All Souls is a society of graduates, distinguished either by promise or achievement, mostly academic, from home and abroad, with a sprinkling of men who have made their mark in other fields. The college has no undergraduates, and generally appears to the outside world to do much as it pleases with its massive financial and intellectual resources." Stephen and Harvey took their places among the 100 or more guests at the long table in the noble Codrington Library. Stephen spent the entire time ensuring that Harvey was kept fully occupied and was not too obvious. He was thankfully aware that on such occasions, people never remember whom they meet or what they say, and happily introduced Harvey to everyone around as a distinguished American philanthropist. He was fortunately placed some way from the vice-chancellor, the registrar, and the secretary of the university chest. Harvey was quite overcome by the new experience, and was content just to listen to the distinguished men around him, which surprised Stephen, who had feared he would never stop talking. When the meal was over and the guests had risen, Stephen drew a deep breath and played one of his riskier cards. He deliberately marched Harvey up to the Chancellor.
"Chancellor," he said to Harold Macmillan.
"Yes, young man. May I introduce Mr. Harvey Metcalf from Boston? Mr. Metcalf, as you will know, Chancellor, is a great benefactor of Harvard."
"Yes, of course. Capital, capital. What brings you to England, Mr. Metcalf?"
Harvey was nearly speechless.
Chancellor, I came to see my horse Rosalie run in the King George and Elizabeth Stakes."
Stephen was now standing behind Harvey and made signs to the Chancellor that Harvey's horse had won the race. Harold Macmillan, as game as ever and never one to miss a trick, replied,
"Well, you must have been very pleased with the results, Mr. Metcalf." "Well, sir, I guess I was lucky."
"You don't look to me the type of man who depends on luck."
Stephen took his career firmly in both hands. "I am trying to interest Mr. Metcalf in supporting some research we are doing at Oxford, Chancellor."
"What a good idea."
No one knew better than Harold Macmillan, after 7 years of leading a political party, how to use flattery on such occasions.
"Keep in touch, young man. Boston, was it, Mr. Metcalf? Do give my regards to the Kennedys."
Macmillan swept off, resplendent in his academic dress. Harvey stood dumbfounded.
"What a great man. What an occasion. I feel I'm part of history. I just wish I deserved to be here."
Having completed his task, Stephen was determined to escape before any mistakes could be made. He knew Harold Macmillan would shake hands with and talk to over 1,000 people that day, and the chances of his remembering Harvey were minimal. In any case, it would not much matter if he did. Harvey was, after all, a genuine benefactor of Harvard.
"We ought to leave before the senior members, Mr. Metcalf."
"Of course, Rod. You're the boss."
"I think that would be courtesy."
Once they were out on the street, Harvey glanced at his large Jaeger LeCoultre watch. It was 2:30 p.m.
"Excellent,"
said Stephen, who was running 3 minutes late for the next rendezvous.
We have just over an hour before the garden party. Why don't we take a look at one or two of the colleges? They walked slowly up past Brasenose College, and Stephen explained that the name really meant Brasnose, and that the famous original Brasnose, a sanctuary knocker of the 13th century, was still mounted in the hall. 100 yards further on, Stephen directed Harvey to the right. "He's turned right, Robin, and he's heading toward Lincoln College," said James, well hidden in the entrance of Jesus College. "Fine," said Robin, and checked his two sons. Aged 7 and 9, they stood awkwardly, in unfamiliar Eton suits, ready to play their part as pages, unable to understand what Daddy was up to. "Are you both ready?"
"Yes, Daddy,"
they replied in unison. Stephen continued walking slowly toward Lincoln, and they were no more than a few paces away when Robin appeared from the main entrance of the college in the official dress of the Vice-Chancellor, bands, collar, white tie, and all. He looked 15 years older and as much like Mr. Habakkuk as possible. Perhaps not quite so bald, thought Stephen.
"Would you like to be presented to the Vice-Chancellor?" asked Stephen.
"That would be something," said Harvey. "Good afternoon, Vice-Chancellor. May I introduce Mr. Harvey Metcalf?" Robin doffed his academic cap and bowed. Stephen returned the compliment in like manner. Robin spoke before Stephen could continue. "Not the benefactor of Harvard University." Harvey blushed and smiled at the two little boys who were holding the Vice-Chancellor's train. Robin continued, "This is a pleasure, Mr. Metcalf. I do hope you are enjoying your visit to Oxford. Mind you, it's not everybody who's fortunate enough to be shown around by a Nobel laureate. I've enjoyed it immensely, Vice-Chancellor, and I'd like to feel I could help this university in some way." "Well, that is excellent news. Look, gentlemen, I'm staying here at the Randolph Hotel. It would be my great pleasure if you could all have tea with me later this afternoon."
Robin and Stephen were thrown for a moment. He'd done it again, the unexpected. Surely the man realized that on the day of Encinia, the Vice-Chancellor did not have a moment free to attend private tea parties. Robin recovered first.
"I'm afraid that would be difficult. One has so many responsibilities on a day like this, you understand. Perhaps you could join me in my rooms at the Clarendon Building. That would give us a chance to have a more private discussion."
Stephen immediately picked up the lead. "How kind of you, Vice-Chancellor. Will 4:30 be convenient?"
"Yes, yes.
That will be fine, Professor."
Robin tried not to look as if he wanted to run a mile. Although they had only been standing there for about 5 minutes, to him it seemed a lifetime. He had not objected to being a journalist or an American surgeon, but he genuinely hated being a Vice-Chancellor. Surely someone would appear at any moment and recognize him for the fraud he was. Thank God most of the undergraduates had gone home the week before. He began to feel even worse when a tourist started taking photos of him. Now Harvey had turned all their plans upside down. Stephen could only think of Jean-Pierre and of James, the finest string to their dramatic bow, loitering uselessly in fancy dress behind the tea tent at the garden party in the grounds of Trinity College, waiting for them.
"Perhaps it might be wise, Vice-Chancellor, if we were to invite the Registrar and the Secretary of the University Chest to join us."
"First-class idea, Professor. I'll ask them to be there. It isn't every day we're visited by such a distinguished philanthropist. I must take my leave of you now, sir, and proceed to my garden party. An honour to have made your acquaintance, Mr. Metcalf, and I look forward to seeing you again at 4:30.
They shook hands warmly, and Stephen guided Harvey toward Exeter College, while Robin darted back into the little room in Lincoln that had been arranged for him. He sank heavily into a seat.
"Are you all right, Daddy?"
asked his elder son, William.
"Yes, I'm fine. Do we get the ice cream and Coca-Cola you promised us if we didn't say a word?"
"You certainly do," said Robin. Robin slipped off all the paraphernalia, the gown, hood, bow tie and bands, and placed them back in a suitcase. He returned to the street, just in time to watch the real Vice-Chancellor, Mr. Habakkuk, leave Jesus College on the opposite side of the road, obviously making his way toward the garden party. Robin glanced at his watch. If they had run 5 minutes late, the whole plan would have struck disaster. Meanwhile, Stephen had done a full circle and was now heading toward Shepherd and Woodward, the tailor's shop which supplies academic dress for the university. He was, however, preoccupied with the thought of getting a message through to James.
Stephen and Harvey came to a halt in front of the shop window.
"What magnificent robes! That's the gown of a doctor of letters. Would you like to try it on and see how you look?"
"That would be great." "But would they allow it?" said Harvey.
"I'm sure they won't object."
They entered the shop, Stephen still in his full academic dress as a doctor of philosophy.
"My distinguished guest would like to see the gown of a doctor of letters."
"Certainly, sir," said the young assistant, who was not going to argue with a fellow of the university.
He vanished to the back of the shop and returned with a magnificent red gown, with grey facing, and a black, floppy velvet cap. Stephen forged on, brazen-faced.
"Why don't you try them on, Mr. Metcalf? Let's see what you would look like as an academic."
The assistant was somewhat surprised. He wished Mr. Venables would return from his lunch break.
"Would you care to come through to the fitting room, sir?"
Harvey disappeared. Stephen slipped out onto the road.
"James, can you hear me?"
"Oh, hell, for God's sake, answer, James."
"Cool down, old fellow. I'm having a deuce of a time putting on this ridiculous gown. And in any case, our rendezvous isn't for another 17 minutes.
Cancel it."
"Cancel it?"
"Yes, and tell Jean-Pierre as well. Both of you report to Robin and meet up as quickly as possible. He will fill you in on the new plans."
"New plans? Is everything all right, Stephen?"
"Yes, better than I could have hoped for."
Stephen clicked off his speaker and rushed back into the tailor shop. Harvey reappeared as a doctor of letters, a more unlikely sight Stephen had not seen for many years.
"You look magnificent. What do they cost?"
"About £100, I think."
No. How much would I have to give?"
"I have no idea."
"You would have to discuss that with the Vice Chancellor after the garden party." Harvey took a long look at himself in the mirror, and then returned to the dressing room while Stephen thanked the assistant, asked him to wrap up the gown and cap, and send them to the Clarendon building to be left with the porter in the name of Sir John Betjeman. He paid in cash. The assistant looked even more bewildered.
"Yes, sir."
He was not sure what to do, except continue praying for Mr. Venables' arrival. His prayers were answered some 10 minutes later, but by then Stephen and Harvey were well on their way to Trinity College and the garden party.
"Mr. Venables, I've just been asked to send the full D-lit dress to Sir John Betjeman at the Clarendon building."
"Strange. We kitted him out for this morning's ceremony weeks ago. I wonder why he wants a second outfit. He paid cash."
"Well, send it around to the Clarendon.
But be sure it's in his name."
When Stephen and Harvey arrived at Trinity College shortly after 3:30, the elegant green lawns, the croquet hoops having been removed, were already crowded with over 1,000 people. The members of the university wore an odd hybrid dress, best lounge suits or silk dresses topped with gowns, hoods and caps. Cups of tea and crates of strawberries and cucumber sandwiches were disappearing rapidly.
"What a swell party this is," said Harvey, unintentionally mimicking Frank Sinatra. "You certainly do things in style here, Professor."
"Yes, the garden party is always rather fun. It's the main social event of the university year, which, as I explained, is just ending. Half the senior members here will be snatching an afternoon off from reading examination scripts. Exams for the final year undergraduates have only just ended."
Stephen observed the vice-chancellor, the registrar and the secretary of the university chest carefully, and steered Harvey well away from them, introducing him to as many of the older members of the university as possible, hoping they would not find the encounter too memorable. They spent just over 3/4 of an hour moving from person to person, Stephen feeling rather like an aide-de-camp to an incompetent dignitary whose mouth must be kept shut for fear of a diplomatic incident. Despite Stephen's anxious approach, Harvey was clearly having the time of his life.
"Robin? Robin, can you hear me?"
"Yes, James."
"Where are you?"
"I'm in the Eastgate restaurant. Come and join me here and bring Jean-Pierre."
"Fine. We'll be there in 5 minutes. No, make it 10. With my disguise, I'd better go slowly."
Robin paid his bill. The children had finished their reward, so he took them out of the Eastgate to a waiting car and instructed the driver, who had been hired especially for the day, to return them to Newbury. They had played their part and now could only get in the way.
"Aren't you coming home with us, Dad?"
demanded Jamie.
"No, I'll be back later tonight. Tell your mother to expect me about 7.
Robin returned to the east gate to find Jean-Pierre and James hobbling toward him.
"Why the change of plan?"
asked Jean-Pierre. "It's taken me over an hour to get dressed and ready."
"Never mind. You're still in the right gear. We had a stroke of luck. I chatted up Harvey in the street, and the cocky bastard invited me to tea with him at the Randolph Hotel. I said that would be impossible, but asked him to join me at the Clarendon. Stephen suggested that you two should be invited along as well."
"Clever," said James. "No need for the deception at the garden party."
"Let's hope it's not too clever," said Jean-Pierre.
"Well, at least we can do the whole damn charade behind closed doors," said Robin, "which ought to make it easier. I never did like the idea of walking through the streets with him."
"With Harvey Metcalf, nothing is ever going to be easy," said Jean-Pierre.
"I'll get myself into the Clarendon building by 4:15, continued Robin. "You will appear a few minutes after 4:20, Jean-Pierre, and then you, James, about 4:25 p.m. But keep exactly to the same routine. Act as if the meeting had taken place, as originally planned, at the garden party, and we had all walked over to the Clarendon together.